91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program begins with a look at the Night Cities Challenge and the Miami area winners who received grants for innovative green projects. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper here. The Knight Foundation sponsors this national grant program in 26 communities. The goal is to make cities more vibrant places to live and to work. One of the Miami-based winners is Code for Miami, which works on civic technology for better government websites and apps. Then there's a cool idea for the proposed Underline project in South Miami-Dade County. It will create a sports field and gym within its confines beneath the Metro Rail. And more, Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining looks at green kitchen upgrades. Stay tuned. Topical Currents next. First News. And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We expect Bonnie Berman to be back next week. So today we begin with discussion of three award-winning Miami area projects of the Knight Foundation's 2016 Cities Challenge. The challenge centers on helping cities attract and keep talented people, increase economic possibilities, and to encourage civic engagement. We'll learn more about several winning projects in just a few moments. With us is the Miami Program Director of the Knight Foundation's Communities Program in South Florida. He's Matt Hagman. Welcome back, Matt.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Matt is a veteran South Florida-based journalist as well. And tell us a little bit more about, with a thumbnail, of what the Cities Project is all about.
Sure, yeah. A year ago, we launched the Knight Cities Challenge, and it's a challenge that asks, what's your idea to help make your city more successful? And we dedicate $5 million to these winning ideas that can come from anywhere, but actually must actually be executed and implemented in one of our 26 Knight Cities. These are the cities where the Knight brothers, our founders, used to publish newspapers.
So you have to look into the practicality of them also.
That's right. And so, and delighted that a year ago we had one winner from Miami, the Miami Science Barge, which is actually having its launch event tomorrow and is now underway and absolutely terrific. I think all of us are on the table here have had the pleasure to visit, and it's simply awesome. And this year, delighted to say that we had 37 winners in Knight Cities across the country, and three are from Miami who you're going to meet. And the whole thought here is that it's not going to, it can be, but it doesn't have to be, established organizations and institutions applying for funding, but it could also be an individual with an idea, a group that's working on a particular idea to make our city better and more successful and to drive impact in around the areas that you mentioned, expanding opportunity, talent retention and attraction, and trying to, you know, let's help create a greater community of problem solvers. And this is a way to have.
Now, we probably have some ambitious people listening right now. How about if they are interested in applying for next year's grants?
We encourage them to do it next fall. So look for it. It'll open
time
next fall.
Time to start, though, is probably now.
Start thinking about the idea, but it's not time to submit for it. But it'll be this, but absolutely. And that's what we hope from this competition. That's what that'll do. That'll get each one of us, as we think about problems to solve in our community, opportunities to take advantage of, that this is one way to get the funds to actually to carry it out.
What is the key to the selection process? Well, does it need matching money? And
it doesn't. I mean, the thing that it has to be innovative. It has to drive change in a sort of a unique and impactful way in that particular community. But in addition to all that, you have to be able to deliver on it. You have to have the capacity to actually carry it out. And as you'll hear, our three winners here in Miami are all people who are enormously capable, who have already been doing really remarkable things across the community and now have an idea to do even more.
Well, Matt Hagman, let's learn more with some of our Cities Project winners. We have Meg Daly, welcoming her back. She's the founder of the Underline. You'll learn more about that project. It's an ambitious one to convert land beneath the metro rail lines next to US 1 in South Dade to public areas. Welcome, Meg. Tell us more about your project for Underline.
Well, the project of the Underline is 10 miles long, but the submission that we're a winner for with the Knight Foundation is our outdoor gym and basketball court below Metro Rail's station in the Brickell area, which is going to be our first construction area. And I think that it was selected out of, what, over 4,000 applications nationwide?
Yes.
Because it's really all about attracting young talent, keeping them here, giving them the urban amenities that they seek, including great public spaces.
Could you be the eyes of our listeners and let them kind of envision what this immense project will be like?
Sure. It goes from the Miami River just north of Brickell Station down to Dadeland South. This is all county land, but it goes through three municipalities, 5 miles in the city of Miami, goes through Coral Gables and South Miami. And also, it will be connecting over the river into downtown and to exciting things that the DDA is doing. And we want to have two trails, one for pedestrians, one for bicyclists. We need to light the facility. We're going to be using native vegetation and a number of park-like attractions and destinations, everything from
basketball
courts.
Solar lighting, probably.
We would like to introduce solar. And this is a sustainable initiative and I think a demonstration of how we can build out a city while also building out park spaces so we can grow and develop without forgetting what happens on the street.
Now, this is a public and private project, correct?
Well, the private side is the 501c3 nonprofit Friends of the Underline, and the public side is Miami-Dade County, who's made a large contribution towards the project, as well as the state. There's also federal dollars and municipal dollars, so it's a lot of layers.
What will be the business ramifications of this? It seems like if you're drawing a lot of people there, it's a great place for small businesses.
Well, one of the great things about this is it's been done well other places. Mm-hmm. And so we definitely want to make it Miami's
Atlanta
own.
Atlanta is a big one.
Atlanta,
right?
Beltline is fabulous, and that's probably a good close cousin example of what we're doing. But the numbers are proven that if you put green spaces in the ground in urban areas, you attract a lot of economic development and really quality development so that it connects to the green space and becomes a larger fabric. And the numbers are really pretty astounding. The return on investment is quite large in terms of real estate value appreciation and new job creation and really economic output.
Before we move on to the other projects, what's the where are you now as far as getting this built? I think it's coming pretty soon.
I hope so. You know, we're going to start building in 2017, and we've completed our master plan. We're embarking on our design for the Brickell phase, which is phase one. We're going to have probably 6 phases.
Knew it was complicated, but you didn't know it was so complicated, I'm sure.
We need a whole show for that.
But Meg's leadership has been extraordinary, working through cities, county, Florida Department of Transportation, mm-hmm. and on, the state government. It's really been remarkable. And might add, this is a case where with the master plan, mm-hmm. that night we were proud to provide funding to help develop the master plan, and now following on is mm-hmm. now Meg is getting close to putting a shovel in the ground to actually launching the Brickell backyard.
Well, you know, even before the master plan funding, Matt was one of the early believers and you know, said, look, you're unproven, but I like your idea, and so one of the first people that wrote a check. Thank you.
Well, we're going to learn
you're
more.
Welcome, absolutely.
We're going to learn more about the Knight Foundation's more about the Knight Foundation's 2016 City Challenge. We're going to take a short break and be back with more. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Thursday edition. We resume our conversation about the Knight Foundation's 2016 Cities Challenges. We have several winning project directors on hand with us. And we turn now to Rebecca Monson. She'll tell us about the Miami Civic Users Testing Group by CODE. What does that mean?
So Code for Miami is a group of nerds, basically, who get together on Monday nights to try to build better apps and websites for Miami-Dade County. So we work closely with local governments to help them build better technology by the people for the people. And the Civic User Testing Group is a really unique opportunity for us because Miami-Dade County is redesigning its web portal. So miamidade.gov, which everyone has to use.
And sometimes find exasperating.
Right, right. So we're trying to help you with that. We are going to get users from all over the county in various neighborhoods with various demographics to do actual hands-on testing of prototypes as they redesign and redevelop the website. And the county will be right there with us to watch users use the product.
So you watch where they click and the progression of, as they go through the website.
Absolutely.
Get in deeper then.
Absolutely. And the goal is really to help them adopt modern web development practices that are focused on users, right? So like you and I have to use this website. How do we make it easier, more efficient, more effective? And Miami-Dade County is really excited about this project as well. And we can't wait because it means that we're going to be organizing people around the county to really think about the technology that our local governments use in a way that we haven't ever seen before in Miami.
Where do most governmental and civic websites go wrong? Sometimes they're very self-congratulatory.
That's a great question. You know, I think the key is that no one ever wants to do a bad job. And so sometimes things that we think are intuitive are not intuitive to users. And it's why it's really important to get real people into the design and development process of building technology. And I think everyone now in the county and in city governments around Miami-Dade is really turning an eye toward this. And we hope that this project will be a launch pad to organize the users that are willing to do that testing for all kinds of government tech.
Are you looking for volunteers?
Or we sure are. So,
how can people get in contact then?
You can check us out on Twitter or Facebook for right now, or on our website, which is code4.miami. We're just doing some information gathering right now, and we will have sign-up information. We'll be recruiting user testers in the coming months.
And can people stop by the Monday meetup?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So we meet Monday nights 7 to 9 p.m. at the Lab Miami in Wynwood. So everyone's welcome. You don't need any tech expertise to help. We need people of all abilities to come and help.
Tell us more about you.
I run a local media startup called The Nootropic, and I am just really excited about Miami itself and anything that I can do to get more people involved in doing cool work like what is honored in the City's Challenge or just these really, Miami's in this renaissance moment, and the more we can get people motivated to participate and really put their sweat into that, that's the stuff I want to work on.
Matt Hagman, are you aware of this renaissance moment? Explain it.
You know, actually, the answer is yes, and we see it every day. I mean, as you know, we reimagine our city that's going through this remarkable transformation right now, and the beauty of it is it's really happening at the grassroots. We see it at the Lab Miami. We see it at community groups led by Meg, reimagining what the underlying, this 10-mile stretch, can look like. We're soon going to see it on Biscayne Boulevard, as we'll hear shortly, thanks to the Miami Downtown Development Authority. No, we're seeing an entire remaking of the city from the bottom up, and it's palpable. I mean, it's leading to things that, you know, a couple of years ago we talked a lot about this brain drain. I would argue we're in the middle of this brain gain right now. I'd say on a weekly basis I'm having a phone conversation or a meeting with someone who's just coming back, who wants to be part of this exciting transformation in Miami.
How is the grant funding level determined?
Well, it starts with what are the needs for the project? What does the person need to actually carry out that project? And then we go from there. But what are those costs?
Do they get what they ask for usually?
Sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes. Sure.
Let's turn now to another winning project, the Knight Foundation's 2016 Cities Challenge. We're joined by Fabian de la Esbriella. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Close enough.
Yes.
So tell us more about what's happening in the Biscayne Corridor and how this project is set up and what it does.
Yes. So I am a member of the Miami DDA, Downtown Development Authority. And
let's watch our acronyms as we go here.
Yes, that's right, because there's a lot of them. But we've been working for a few years now on this transformational proposal to redesign Biscayne Boulevard to include a world-class pedestrian promenade. And
would this be?
So the full vision of this project goes from Second Avenue, basically from the Metro Mover Station Bayfront all the way to 8th, so close to the Port Boulevard, you know, where we have the big medians. And so the hope is to transform the boulevard in that segment of Biscayne Boulevard to accommodate.
So just the very downtown segment.
Correct, correct. And the vision for this project is to actually provide spaces for other street users. And so this project, it's a project to transform the boulevard itself, but it's also about changing the paradigm and how people think and conceive these types of transportation projects, where transportation
what
has
needs
been,
to be changed in that thought?
Transportation has been conventionally being thought of only for moving cars, and the paradigm shifting towards accommodating pedestrians, cyclists, transit users. So this is about this change that the city is going through, this renaissance where people are opting for using other modes of transportation to get to places, because it's about active living and lifestyle and quality of life. And these are the things that need to be folded in into the transportation process, and we need to accommodate for those users as well.
So how does this project affect that change?
So our application, it's basically, it's a three-block demonstration project where we will be creating a temporary park and a street demonstration, where we want to take a segment of the boulevard and provide for a bus-only lane and provide on-street parking, so effectively reducing the travel lane capacity of the boulevard on one segment. And then twofold to that, it's creating this amazing pop-up park where we would create
now,
spaces.
What is a pop-up park?
So it's a temporary installation where we provide or we create spaces where we can engage artists and we can have music and we can have food trucks.
So it moves around somewhat.
So it's creating public space in the medians, but it's temporary in a sense that we're planning for it to be for a month long, and that's the temporary effect of it. And we want to program it in a way that we provide spaces to escape, to play, to entertain. And so we want to see tables and chairs and umbrellas for people to walk out and have lunch. And we want to have an area for families to come out and play with their children in a playground. And we also want to cater to those who come out at night and play before a heat game and just have a drink, eat something out of a food truck and lounge. You know, we see a lot of these activities happening in Wynwood, and we just want to create that fun, hip environment. Downtown Miami has become a neighborhood, and we want to cater to this neighborhood that it's willing and hungry to have these types of spaces.
Well, this project also talks about an urban forest. What's
right.
that facet?
So the urban forest, it speaks to the temporary park, and we want to see installations where the urban forest concept could come through as art installations. We want to see landscaping as well. So we're thinking of actively using the pods where parking is right now to bring green.
So it emphasizes, though, that it is an urban area.
Absolutely.
And it has a balance to that.
Yes.
And Fabian, correct me if I'm wrong, but what we talk about this renaissance transformation that we're seeing in Miami, one of them is, of course, the growth of our downtown. And our downtown population over the last 6 to 7 years has nearly doubled. If we've
yes,
reached
in the
that,
last 10 years, that, it's doubled.
It has doubled in the last 10 years. And that's leading to things and people leading lives in ways that we didn't previously in Miami. For example, we hired a new associate in our Miami program at Knight Foundation just this year. He started in January. To date, he still has yet to buy a car. And he lives in the downtown area and doesn't own a car and gets around using Metro Mover, Metro Rail, Uber. walking. And that's a different Miami. That's the Miami of 10 years ago, someone who wanted to live
so
that
many
kind of
condos
life, so
now
do
available
it.
In the downtown area. People can't certainly get around like that without owning cars.
That's right. We have to find a different way to get around, and one of them, of course, is walking, and that's why installations such as this are so important, because we have to build the public realm in Miami for downtown ultimately to be a place that people want to be in.
Meg Daly, I'd like to hear the story about how you sort of founded the Underline project by accident, so to speak.
I did. I had a bike accident and had to discover my city without driving because I couldn't drive for 2 months. And I ended up taking Metro Rail and near University of Miami to Coconut Grove and walked below the train tracks to get to my destination and realized just how much space was below Metro Rail. The Underline will produce 120 new acres of open space. And also the fact that nobody else was out there. And then we had the shade of the train tracks, so it gave a little bit of reprieve from the Florida sun. So that was my aha moment. But I wanted to add on just real quickly what Matt was talking about. Really, this is happening nationwide. The ability to be able to walk and bike and the demand for that, the demand for having a walkable community is far outstripping our supply. And it's hard to rebuild a city. And I think projects like what the DDA is doing, and also throughout the community with these demonstrations of what could be, we seem to have a community that says, you got to show me before I'll buy. And so we're all working hard to give them the pictures of what the experience could be like once we've transformed our city to really sort of be more walkable, bikeable, and I think more sustainable long term.
Fabian, tell us a little more about your background and how you got involved in the DDA and urban planning.
Sure thing. I have a background in architecture, and after that, I felt very interested in the terms of, in the topics of urbanism, and so I went and did a master's in urban and regional planning with an emphasis in urban design, and so that's how I started my career in the urban design realm. And I did consulting for about 7-8 years, and then I jumped to the public sector, and that's how I ended at the DDA.
Now, do you practice what you preach? Do you take a lot of public transportation and
absolutely.
Bike?
Absolutely. I take the trolley as often as I can, and I actually biked to come over here with a city bike.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Very good. Matt Hagman, tell us more about, for those who might be stimulated a little bit by listening to our program this afternoon, who want to get involved in this and maybe apply for a Knight Foundation Cities Challenge.
Well, get your ideas ready. I mean, number one, of course, we have three terrific initiatives here in addition to last year with the Miami Science Barge.
And people need to know it might be a long shot.
This past year is over 4,500 applications across the country, 37 winners, right? So it's very hard to be a winner. It's terrific, and it shows the great energy and ideas we have here in Miami, that three of the winners were here across Knight's 26 cities. I should mention, Miami's also Knight's hometown.
John and James Knight, of course, the long newspaper tradition.
That's
of
right.
Course. What other winners in Florida?
We've had the musical Swings in West Palm. My focus area is here in Miami, but we had...
There was the one in Palm Beach, and I think that was it.
And that was it, mm-hmm. So... Which is an installation where an installation that in a public space creates these swings that as you swing creates music, so it becomes this public gathering point, hopefully creating greater sense of place and hopefully establishing sort of more community engagement as people visit this public place.
Well, we certainly enjoyed hearing about this the Knight Foundation's 2016 City Challenge. We want to thank Fabian Della Espriella, also Matt Hagman. He's the Miami Program Director of the Knight Foundation's Communities Program in South Florida. Also, Meg Daly of the Underline and Rebecca Monson of the Miami Civic User Testing Group by Code. Thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And good luck on your projects. Food and Dining up next. And we're back, 32 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Well, as usual, our friend Linda Gassenheimer is in the studio. It must be Thursday. Linda is our resident chef, author, and producer, world famous for the syndicated Dinner in Minutes column, and the author of numerous popular food and dining-related books, including 4 about diabetes and diet. So today we're talking, Linda, green kitchens. Green meaning not color, but eco-pleasing.
Eco-friendly. Hello, Joe. Nice to be with you. And we're wishing Bonnie well.
She'll be back next week.
Yes, great. Wonderful. So, you know, Earth Day is tomorrow. So that made me thinking even more about...
I was there for the first Earth Day. A big demonstration.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. That's good. So how can we make our kitchens eco-friendly, either if we're building a new one or we have one and we want to make it better? We've got somebody who's going to help us out. And that's Carmen Guerrero, and she's from the University of Miami School of Architecture, and she also has an architectural and interior design firm. So she's got lots of information. Let's welcome Carmen Guerrero.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, she's got lots of information. We've been talking about this before the show. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any green kitchen questions for us? Or maybe you have some tips for our expert. Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Radio at WLRN.org if you're a little shy and want to email.
Or get in quickly with your emails. Okay, and of course, we'd like to say hello to our favorite wine columnist, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. Fred writes the wine suggestions for my Miami Herald Dinner in Minutes columns, and you can read his wine column. It's in Saturday's Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Passover starts tomorrow, so I'm going to talk about some good kosher wines for it.
Oh, that's right. Good for you. Okay, that sounds great. So let's go to Carmen Guerrero. Creating a greener kitchen. First, let's talk about improving the existing kitchens, and then we'll talk about a new kitchen. But first of all, what does it mean? What makes a kitchen green?
What makes a kitchen green has to do with the amount of energy, effort, and also cleanliness of the materials you're using, so that they're not releasing any toxins into the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're starting with an existing kitchen, you can do a lot with materials. You can change the flooring. You can choose flooring that is sustainable.
So what would that be?
That would be bamboo flooring is a good sustainable.
Because I know bamboo, for example, I have a bamboo cutting board, which I love because it dries so quickly. It's easy to clean. But I never heard of it being on the floor.
Yeah, there is bamboo flooring. Cork flooring has shown to be also quite environmentally friendly. You don't have to cut down trees because it comes from the bark of the oak tree. You have to be careful with wood floors because sometimes they're processed with formaldehyde. The important thing is for consumers to ask questions, to investigate and to find out where things are coming from and how they're being put together.
So what could we do if we weren't going to go into a big... a big deal like putting new floors in and things. What are some small steps we could take?
Small steps are change out of appliances and change out of lighting. You know, now LED lighting is performing extremely well, and you're saving a lot of energy just by changing fluorescent, halogen, and incandescent existing lighting to LED lighting. So that's a big
and the LED lighting, I understand, is cooler.
It is cooler.
But it doesn't give off as much light.
Well, that is changing. There are lots of types of bulbs that you can purchase today. You can get a warm bulb, you can get colder bulbs, so there's a little bit more variety today on the type of LED bulb that you can use. The bulb, it's not made of glass, so it doesn't break. You're saving, again, on energy, so we have a lot more variety today.
Well, that's great. And lighting, of course, to me, you can... design, you can change the whole look of a room by having the right lighting or having natural light if your kitchen has that.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point because if you go to any lighting retailer, they should have something installed, a mock-up, where you can test the different types of LED bulbs, and that gives you a pretty close idea of what the reality will be like.
Now, these bulbs aren't replaceable, though.
they are not replaceable, but they last a very long time.
What if they don't?
If they don't, usually you're covered warranty. In my experience, I've had 3 to 5 year warranty on bulbs.
What do you mean they're not replaceable?
Well, like if they're built into a light fixture, it's not like you can unscrew it and put in a
No,
bulb.
No, you can.
Yeah, you,
you can.
What about the ones I have?
Well, you need to talk to Carmen afterwards.
Right. We need to take you shopping.
She's going to set you up. okay, so now you mentioned appliances. And, you know, it's expensive to go and replace appliances, but what would you look for if you're going to do that?
Well, one place to start is for the to look for energy, the Energy Saver, Energy Star label. That's an indication that the appliance has met certain, you know, criteria to be energy efficient. But a great place to the refrigerator, for example, it's the single largest energy consumer in most homes. So that's one place where you want to make sure you select one with the Energy Star rating. Also, in terms of design, it's a good idea to not position it near a heat source, such as the oven, dishwasher, or even direct sunlight.
So that would affect how the refrigerator works?
That does, because it would need to work more to cool if it's receiving a lot of heat from the exterior.
Okay. So now we were talking earlier, just little things we do all every day that might say, for example, with the refrigerator.
Tell us about that. It's funny because a lot of people, I mean, myself included, you know, you open the refrigerator and you stand there a little while looking at what's in there. That's actually the biggest energy consumers to just keep the refrigerator door open. If you keep everything super organized and you know you have a better sense of what's where, you don't need to leave it open for so long. So that's just a kind of habit.
So you know the milk is always on that shelf and the fruit is always in this bin and the others in that bin, so you can quickly go in and out and know what you
Correct.
Want instead
Correct.
Of just go grazing. I'm hungry. I don't know what I want. Okay. And let's have a stand at the refrigerator to see what I'm going to have.
Yeah. Another solution is the glass front refrigerator door that some manufacturers make, just that you have to be very neat, right?
Linda, a while back we did a program similar to this, and you pointed out something that I've become very conscious of, and that's if you have a single-handled faucet, if you leave it over on the hot water side, you're using hot water out of your hot water heater all the time, even if you want cold water. You don't know it's hot until it runs hot.
Oh, I see.
So
right.
So you're wasting.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That wasting water is still coming out of the hot water heater, and you're paying for that energy.
Exactly, and you're paying. Or
so keep it over on the right side so you're getting cold water.
And that's a simple thing to do if you can remember to do it.
Yeah.
Right. And the other thing is, I see a lot of people just leave the water running while they go across the room and get a pot and come back. You know, I mean, it uses a lot.
You can also, since you're talking about faucets, you can also, if you're working with an existing condition, you can purchase an aerator for the faucet. It's an inexpensive way to save water, and these things cost like $5. So you can add this to your existing faucet.
It means less water's coming through?
The way it works, it mixes air into the water to maintain pressure.
And it doesn't splash.
But it reduces the amount of water flow.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
Yeah. So
it's a simple thing you could do.
It's a simple thing you could do.
Right. Right. And so let's talk about stoves, because I'm always asked, you know, should we have gas? Should we have electric? Okay. Should we have induction?
Okay. Well, I'm an advocate for induction, and perhaps it's because of personal experience, but I have found that it is extremely fast. You know, it works fast. It heats things up quickly. It boils water quickly. It also, it saves energy because of this. And actually, statistics I checked earlier, it uses half the energy of a standard electric stovetop. So if you are a diehard gas stove lover, then you know that's one thing. But I have found great benefits to induction because it also cooks evenly. It has a very
well, and I find that you know when people say, "Oh, I can't have gas. I'm in an apartment, a condo, or whatever," and I don't like the electricity. I always say, "Well, induction really. I mean, when you take the pan off of that induction hob, then." It's cold. You can put your hand on it.
That's right. Yeah, and the key is to use the burner that is closest in size to the pot, always with any kind of...
So if it's a small pot, small burner.
Small burner.
Because otherwise you put on a
You're heating
big
more
one.
Surface than you need.
Right. It'll just heat the whole air instead of as well as the pot.
I guess that's
right.
Good to control also for induction for very slow simmering to make sure nothing burns.
Right, and actually that's a good point. because the newer induction models have even more temperature possibilities. You know, you don't more than just low, medium, and high. You have a lot more.
Well, now here's the question. This is a really simple thing that we can do, but I'm not sure I need to do it because it's a nuisance. I've been told to unplug small appliances like your coffee maker or your food processor because when you're not using it, it's drawing electricity. Is that true?
Well, that's a great question because I actually found myself calling FPL to ask them about that and they're energy experts. And
most of them have digital clocks, which draw a little bit.
Yeah, at the end of the day, they said that it's so minimal that it makes almost no difference. Yeah.
So I can leave them plugged in.
You can leave them plugged in.
That's good to know.
Use the money on an induction tub.
Okay, so now let's talk about if we're going to redesign a kitchen or something. What are some things to think about?
Okay, well, size matters. You know, bigger is not always better. So when you're planning the kitchen, you should consider that smaller spaces require less building material, less energy to heat and cool. Involving a designer in a smart layout with wise use of cabinets and countertops will make the difference, you know. So always think that. The size really matters.
Well, it also matters in your own energy because otherwise you're running around a kitchen and you're losing,
that's
using
right.
a lot of energy
right.
to do it.
Making foresighted design decisions so that you plan for durability, you know, so you avoid having to redo things because of things that you didn't plan or foresee, whether it's a growing family or less people using it in the future. You know, it's the busiest place, but life changes over time and the amount of users.
Talk about the busiest place. It reminds me because whenever if you're planning a kitchen or you have a chance to redo what you've got, everyone puts the waste bin, the trash, under the sink. And the sink's one of the most active places in the kitchen. And so for me, I put it in another area of the kitchen because it means that it's a lot easier. I think the kitchen, the refrigerator, and the stove and the sink, they're all busy. So if you put the trash can near there, then you're going to run into each other.
Yeah, it's definitely cumbersome to have it underneath the sink, but I think that the decision is made to get it kind of out of the way and concealed inside cabinetry. If you have more space, then you have the possibility of putting it
concealing
somewhere else.
In another cabinet right. and all to do that. And the other thing is if you want to have, for example, what about cleaning equipment and all? Did you want to have another point you wanted
well,
to
make? Well, I wanted to bring up the topic of natural lighting if you're starting
okay,
from scratch.
Ahead,
you know, planning your windows and planning for receiving as much natural light as you can into the kitchen area so that you rely less on the artificial lighting. You know, it's an ideal situation when you don't have to turn on the lights all the time.
Yeah, that's a good point to make. And we'll come back to the cleaning. But right now, we're going to take a break. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking about cooking green with architect Carmen Guerrero. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking about making our kitchens eco-friendly with Carmen Guerrero. She's from the University of Miami School of Architecture, and she also has her own architectural and interior design firm. And where can they find you, Carmen?
CLGDesignStudio.com.
Okay, so that's CLGDesignStudio.com. Earth Day's tomorrow, and it's time to think about making our homes a little greener. But right now, we're going to think about dinner. And so this dinner, it will not heat up your kitchen. And it's Tuscan bean and tuna salad, and it has a zucchini and tomato salad on the side dish. Now, if you can find Italian canned tuna, that's excellent. So if you're near a specialty store, look for it. Otherwise, use a good quality. And by good quality, I mean it should be sustainably caught. So think in terms of it being wild. It'll say it on the can, caught by troll or pole and line caught tuna. That's the best kind to buy to be eco-friendly. And now for this recipe, the tuna is mixed with cannellini beans and some chopped red onion and tossed with some oil and vinegar dressing and then a little sprinkling of parsley on top. No cooking necessary.
Homemade oil and vinegar dressing.
If you'd like, or you can buy it.
A little Paul Newman's if you want or something.
Whichever brand you love.
All right.
Okay. The zucchini and tomato salad is a side dish. I slice the zucchini and I cook it a little bit in the microwave. So again, you don't heat up a stove. Some tomato cubes, a little olive oil, and I finish that with a little oregano or parsley. So simple,
salt and pepper. You get the tomato cubes like you do at at the grocery store already cut?
You can buy it that way. I cut my own, but yes.
Do you peel them for this?
No.
No, okay.
Because I want the vitamins there.
Just wanted to be sure.
Okay, are you going to make this dish
for us?
You
have to do this in 15 minutes.
Are you good? You can do this in 10 minutes, Joe Cooper. Okay. I know, because you've been cooking lately. Okay. Well, here's a tip. If you're going to be using like dried oregano or dried spices, herbs, then chop them with some parsley, because the juices from the fresh parsley will release the flavors in the dried herb. Now, if you want the complete recipe, and Joe, you can go to the website and get the complete recipe and a photo. That's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking?
As I said, Passover starts tomorrow, so wine, kosher wine, of course, is important to the ritual of the Seder meal. And the good news is that while you can drink the sweet Concord kosher wines if you want, today you have a choice. Years ago, most kosher wines in America were sweet because they were made from grapes grown in upstate New York, and it's pretty cold there. And the grape that grew the best was the Concord, which is too tart to be pleasant to drink unless it has a lot of sugar in it.
So that's why they have the square bottle with the sugary wine?
Yeah, that's why, because the Jewish population was centered in New York City, so they made the wine nearby.
Okay.
Of course, now, today, dry kosher wine is made everywhere. You have California with its Chardonnay, and France with its Merlot, Spain with its Rioja, Israel with the Cabernet Sauvignon, you name it. It's all over the world.
So all these countries are making kosher-style wines?
That's right.
Wow.
And you can tell a kosher wine from the symbol on the back label. If you see a circle with the letter U inside, it's kosher. And if the letter P appears beside it, the wine is a step higher, which is kosher for Passover. Now, kosher wines have to be made by observant Jews, and kosher for Passover wines must also be made with yeast derived from grapes and not from grains. There are a lot of other rules. It could take an hour to talk about all the rules, but you can Google them if you're interested. The back labels of kosher wines also might have the word mevushal. It's M-E-V-U-S-H-A-L, which is Hebrew for cooked or boiled. And in the old days, the wine was literally boiled. Today, they're a little gentler with it. They put the wine in a big machine that they jokingly call a mevushalator and heat it up to 178 degrees where the first tiny bubbles start to form. And then they cool it down right away so they won't boil away the fruit.
So now, that must taste a little better that way.
It doesn't do anything like the damage that boiling would.
Right.
If you boil a wine, it's pretty much ruined. And mevushal wines can be served to Jews by non-Jewish waiters if you were, say, you were holding a meal in a restaurant with non-Jewish waiters or something like that. So here are a couple of nice kosher wines. The 2013 Ramon Cordova Rioja from Spain, which is from the Tempranillo grape. It's very fruity with flavors of black raspberries, and it's $27. Or the 2014 Carmel Winery Cabernet Sauvignon from Upper Galilee in Israel. This has the flavor of black cherries and coffee, and it's $18. So you should enjoy.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and wishing everybody who celebrates it a very happy Passover starting tomorrow night. Well, before we went to break, we did mention quickly a little bit about cleaning products in the kitchen. So are there any, for example, we should be looking for products without phosphates?
That is so, but you can also do a lot with baking soda, vinegar, and citrus.
You know, we were talking before that there's a lot of products to clean your vegetables. That if you read the label, it's really kind of citrus and water.
That's right.
So just put a little lemon juice in your water. I mean, I know when I clean my copper pots, I just salt and vinegar. And that'll do it just as good a job.
Grapefruit is great also for washing produce.
Right. Any kind of citrus
grapefruit
will do it.
Yep, grapefruit.
You squeeze the juice?
Squeeze the juice.
Right. So
I'll have to try that.
Yeah. And
get a little extra vitamin C, too.
You had one more point you wanted to make.
I think it's important for us all to understand that it doesn't have to be an overwhelming task, you know, that the little steps all contribute towards being more energy efficient and reducing the carbon footprint and creating a healthier home. So you don't have to think that you have to sort of change everything if you're working with an existing condition. I think if you embark on a plan to be green, you can think of it as your own nutrition. You know, small steps will get you there, and it's better than none.
Right, so we don't have to redo our floor immediately, right away.
Well, flooring is sort of a pain to do after the fact.
Right, so, but if you, again, you want to take small steps, think in terms of not leaving your refrigerator door open, or, I mean, that's what the kids do a lot. They're in and out every 2 minutes, and I know there are some things you could add a refrigerator draw to your cabinets, because you could put all the drinks and things kids like in that, and that would mean you wouldn't have to open up
a refrigerator drawer.
Right.
In the cabinet.
In a cabinet, sure. Yeah. You can buy them, have it fitted into the cabinet, and you can put whatever you use all the time.
So you're not opening the whole refrigerator just to get one drink out.
There are refrigerators that can be installed under the cabinetry.
Oh, yeah.
And they perform like a cabinet, essentially, like a drawer.
Well, there are some that open up like a cabinet, and there are some that just open up like a drawer. And you can just pull that out, and it's refrigerated. You know, if you Google it, you'll find a lot more about it. So that would be something you could do. And so there's a lot of more information we'd like to give you, but what we've had has really been wonderful. It's been a very interesting week. Thank you, Carmen Guerrero, for these very excellent tips.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
And now it's clgdesignstudios.com. That's your architectural firm. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Joe, nice to be with you, and I hope Bonnie will be back soon.
I'm going to make that tuna tonight.
Well, you'll let me know how it comes out.
Yeah, well, yeah,
I'll
call
okay.
You.
All right, do that. Next week, we're going to be talking with Shannon Allen. She and her husband, Ray Allen, who's from the Heat team, have opened a new organic and fast food restaurant, and it's called Grown. So I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
Yeah, that wraps up today's program. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Polly Landis is associate producer. Find free audio archives of each program at our website. That's WLRN.org. Also, more information at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. Monday, we return with longtime NPR correspondent Barbara Bradley Haggerty about her book, Life Reimagined. Midlife may not be so bad. And surprise, a calendar for April 21st. On this day in 1896, 120 years ago, the first FEC passenger train rolls into the town of Miami. The boom was on. And on this day in 1976, 40 years ago, Barbara Walters becomes Network TV's first news anchor woman when she signs on to co-anchor ABC News alongside Harry Reasoner. Harry wasn't thrilled. One more, while the Miami Heat continued to drub the Charlotte Hornets, on this day in 1988, 28 years ago, Miami is awarded an NBA franchise, the Heat. They were nearly named Miami Vice. They won 15 games that season, and rest in peace, Pearl Washington, of that original team. He died yesterday at age 52. So we leave with a thought from Heat President Pat Riley, who stepped down as coach after the dreadful 2007-2008 season. Quote from Riley, "There's no such thing as coulda, shoulda, woulda. If you coulda and shoulda, you woulda." Joseph Cooper for Linda Gassenheimer and Fred Tasker. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.